for me, I said. I am not used to drinking in the middle of the day.
But this is an ordinary wine. No strength at all. We give it to our children. Makes them strong. And if you wish, you can mix it with some water.
She handed me a carafe of water, and I poured in a little. I was now told to help myself to the items on the board. I tried some of the salami and cheese, and the tomatoes were sweeter than any I had tasted before.
What is the name of this cheese? I asked. It is very different from any cheese I have tasted.
Ah, that is because it is cheese from the sheep and not from the cow, such as you have in your country. It is the cheese that my husband and I used to make once. Pecorino, we call it. It is good, no? Sharp and full of flavor.
It is, I nodded.
Have more, and try this prosciutto.
She put more food on my plate, and while I ate, Paola questioned me. Where did I live? What about my parents? I told her I lived in London and my parents were both dead. She nodded sadly.
It is tragic to lose a loved one. A wound one never recovers from, I fear. My own dear Gianfranco died last year.
I'm very sorry, I said. Was he ill? She shook her head angrily.
No. His truck went off the road and rolled over on the way to the market. It was bad weather. Much rain and wind. But Gianfranco was a good driver. Sometimes I wonder.
Mamma, you must not say these things,
Angelina interrupted. I looked at her inquiringly. My mother thinks that maybe there are men who did not like my father. He was too honest. He would not pay protection money, and he would not sell his land.
It's true. I do wonder often. All I know is my husband was taken from me. Too young. Too young.
So now you have to run the farm on your own? I asked.
It was too much for a woman alone, she said. We used to have sheep and goats for the cheese, but they are gone now. I had to sell them. And you have their little house. My vineyard is rented out to others. I keep a few olive trees for the oil, and I grow vegetables in my garden, as you can see. I take them out to the market once a week, and I make preserves with the fruit. It is enough to get by.
We ate for a while in silence. I felt the wine in my head, and the heat of the afternoon was making me sleepy.
If you don't mind, I'd like to take a little sleep, I said. I was up all night on the train.
Of course.
Paola got up too. And maybe later you could show me how to cook some of your recipes, I said.
It will be a pleasure. You like to cook?
I'd like to learn, I said. My mother was a good cook, but I have never learned to cook anything more than a fried egg.
She never taught you? Paola asked.
No, she died when I was 11. Paola came up to me, her arms open, and took me into an embrace. I smelled garlic and sweat and a faint rosewater type of perfume, but the mixture was not unpleasant.
No young girl should have to grow up without a mother, she said.
I fought back tears. The combination of wine and tiredness meant that I slept for over an hour. I awoke with my head groggy and had to splash water on my face to make myself feel vaguely normal. When I came back to the kitchen, I saw Paola was working at the big table. She greeted me with a smile.
Ah, the little one who wants to cook. You came at the right moment. See, I am making pici. It is a pasta of this region, made with only flour and water. No eggs. Do you want to join me?
Oh yes, thank you. I'd love to, I said. I washed my hands in the sink. Then she showed me her process.
You see, we start with a mound of two types of flour. I like to use semolina as well as the flour we call tipo 00. Very fine, no? And then we make a little well in the middle, and we start to pour in the water, little by little, gently, and we mix, and we start to knead.
I tried to follow along with my pile of flour. It wasn't as easy as she made it look. Flour stuck to my fingers. It became a sticky mess.
More flour, I think,
Paola said kindly, taking over until I had a smooth dough in front of me.
Now comes the real work. We knead and we knead, At least 10 minutes.
Again, I followed along. It was an effort, but it felt good to have my hands working, to be creating something. I found myself relaxing, smiling. I looked around the kitchen as I worked. Bunches of herbs were drying in a corner, tied to a rack, and along one wall were large terracotta jars full of olive oil and other things I couldn't identify from where I was standing.
"Now we must let it rest," Paola said. "Come, we will have a coffee and biscotti while we wait."
She poured 2 cups of thick black coffee and pushed a plate of hard biscuits in front of me. I sat with her and nibbled at them.
"Good, no?" she said. "And the biscotti are better when you dip them in a vin santo. I will show you later."
"It's very good just like this," I said, although I wasn't used to such strong coffee, which hit me with a jolt to the system.
"And now we finish the peachy."
Paola got up and took the cloth from the top of our dough.
"Let me show you how we roll it."
She broke off a piece and put it onto the floured table. Then she rolled it with her hands the way we used to make snakes with modeling clay when I was a little girl. Back and forth she rolled until it was a uniformly thin, long strand. Then she handed me a piece. My strand was not as uniform and even, but I certainly enjoyed the process.
"We will have it tonight with a rabbit ragout," Paola said as we worked. "Those rabbits have become a pest to my vegetables, so I invite the boys from the village to come and shoot them for me. They like to shoot, and I like to eat rabbit. I give them one to take home to their mother, and everyone is happy."
I had to concentrate really hard to understand this, not having learned the word for rabbit. But once she mentioned eating her vegetables in her garden, I managed to guess what she meant. "How do you make a rabbit ragout?"
"Also not hard. You start with pancetta and onions and sage and rosemary, and tomatoes and garlic, of course. And it cooks gently for a long while. I made it early this morning."
I decided the time was right to mention my father. "Signora Rossini, I told you I came here because my father had been in this place during the war." I paused. "He was a British airman. His plane was shot down. Do you remember any of that? A British airman? A plane that crashed nearby?" She gave me an apologetic smile.
"I was not here in the war," she said. "My mother sent me to my aunt up in the hills, on account of the Germans. I was a young girl, and the Germans, they thought it was their right to take any young girl they fancied, just as they thought it was their right to kill whenever they wanted. They were animals. I cannot tell you how much we suffered."
I nodded with understanding. Then I asked, "Do you remember a woman called Sophia Bartoli from this village?"
"Sophia Bartoli? Oh yes, of course I remember her. I remember when her husband Guido brought her home right before the war. She was not from here, you know, so the people of this town did not look upon her favorably. They do not like outsiders. And she was an orphan, I remember, with no family. I was only a little girl, but I thought she was very pretty, and kind, too. I heard she lost her husband in a North African conflict."
"And do you know what happened to her?"
"When I returned to the village when the war was over, she was gone. Nobody said much about it, but it wasn't good. She went away, leaving her baby son."
Chapter 13. Hugo. December 1944. Hugo had a cold and uncomfortable night. His leg throbbed and sent pain shooting through him every time he tried to move, and the blanket did little to shield him from the damp cold that rose up from the stone floor. He took a small sip of the grappa, and it spread like fire through his veins for a while. He felt in his breast pocket and retrieved his cigarettes and lighter, then lay back smoking one, conscious that the tiny circle of glowing tobacco did nothing to dispel the darkness around him. But at least the inhaled smoke calmed his nerves. He was glad to see the first streaks of daylight and to hear that distant rooster welcoming the dawn. He nibbled a little of the polenta and cheese, leaving the onion for later, then forced himself to go outside and find a place to heed the call of nature. It was a clear, crisp day, with occasional white clouds racing across the sky from the west. He managed to hobble out to the rain barrel, wincing with every step, where he drank some water and washed his face and hands. He carried more water back in the tin mug. He also retrieved more stuffing from the pillow and found a spoon lying amid the rubble. That small victory cheered him up. When he felt a bit stronger, he would do more searching. Maybe there was a mattress under some of those fallen roof tiles. He managed to get the mug of water back to the chapel without spilling too much. Then he took down his trousers and tore off some of Sophia's sheet to clean the wound again. It still looked pretty repulsive, with oozing dark blood. But he dripped iodine onto his homemade rag and tried to wipe away as much of the blood as possible. It stung horribly, and he cursed under his breath, conscious of the Virgin and a few damaged saints looking down at him. Then he bound up the wound and used Sophia's piece of wood to make a splint. He wasn't sure it was helping. It certainly didn't support him enough for him to put weight on that leg. There was no way he could make his escape southward. "I'll just have to be patient," he told himself, and was ashamed to find that he felt a small bubble of happiness, that he would be seeing Sophia again for at least a few more days. She came again that afternoon.
"I'm in luck,"
she said, throwing off the shawl from her head as she stepped into the chapel.
"Signora Gucci has told everyone that I brought her Funghi di Bosco yesterday, and have promised to find more mushrooms for her. What a sweet and kind young lady I am. So now, when they see me going up the hill to the woods, they say, 'Ah, Sophia, she goes to hunt the mushrooms, what a good woman.'"
"Well, I hope you find some, or she'll become suspicious."
"I hope so too. But it has been wet recently. Good weather for mushrooms. And I think I saw more chestnuts. That is good, too. We use chestnut flour for baking in this region, especially when there is no more real flour."
She had her big basket on her arm today.
"Let's see what I have brought you. It is fagioli al fiasco sotto la cenere."
She handed him a bowl of what looked like white paste. He didn't understand the Italian words in her dialect, except that fagioli was beans, and this did not look like beans, more like oatmeal. He didn't think he'd ever seen an oat when he was in Florence, and certainly nobody ate oatmeal for breakfast.
"What is this?"
he asked.
"It is made of white beans cooked in water and then cooked again with olive oil, rosemary, sage, and garlic in the coals of the fire all night. We put it in a Chianti bottle and cook it slowly in the embers. Then we mash it. It is very good and nourishing. We eat it all the time these days when there is no meat or eggs to be had."
She reached into the basket again.
"And some bread this time. Signora Gucci already baked us a loaf."
He took the crusty knob that she handed him and used it to scoop up the bean puree. The fagioli was good. So smooth, he thought that milk or cream must have been added to it. She watched him eating, her face like that of a mother who knows she has provided the best nutrition for her child. When he was done, she nodded in satisfaction.
"That will keep you going for a while. And I brought you other things. Here. This is one of Guido's shirts that he used to wear to work in the fields in winter. It is made of wool and will keep you warm."
"I couldn't take Guido's shirt," he said, not wanting to accept it from her outstretched hand.
"Take it, please. He is not here to wear it. And who knows, maybe the moths will get at it, and then it will be useless. And if he returns to me, I will be happy to make him a new shirt from the best cloth at the market."
"Thank you." He took it with reverence.
"And also I think it must be hard to be here in darkness at night. So I've brought you a candle. Please, try to make it last. I do not have many, and we often lose electricity these days. Do you need matches?"
"I have my cigarette lighter." He patted his pocket.
"Do you have cigarettes?"
"Yes. Would you like one?" He fished for the packet. She shook her head.
"I do not smoke, thank you. But it is a pity I cannot let anyone know about you. Cigarettes are the best things to barter with. The men around here would find me a pheasant or a rabbit for a pack of cigarettes."
She paused, then shook her head.
"But alas, English cigarettes would not be a wise thing to show anybody."
"You should go and look for your mushrooms," he said. She stood up.
"You are right. I cannot stay away too long. My son was in tears this morning because he wanted to come with me to help find mushrooms. But I had to tell him it was too far for him to walk. He is afraid, every time I leave, poor little one. He has seen men taken from our village, and he thinks about the father he has never seen.
Please be careful, Sophia, he said. He didn't realize immediately that he had called her by her first name. Their eyes met.
Don't worry about me. I am always careful.
Are there Germans in your village now? She shook her head. There was a long pause, and then she said,
A German staff car came early this morning because someone had reported seeing an aeroplane crash. We told them we heard the noise of a crash, but it was the middle of the night and we saw nothing. And then they went away again.
Hugo let out a sigh of relief. Are they often in your village? She shook her head.
They do not come much these days because they have taken most of what we have. And we are too far from a good road. But we never know. I pray every night to La Madonna that the Americans will come and make them flee north. Arrivederci, Ugo. May God be with you.
In the doorway she paused, adjusted the shawl around her head and shoulders, looked back at him and smiled. He sat still as a statue, watching her go. She's still a child, he thought. If she had married at 18, then she was still in her early 20s, and yet she bore this worry and deprivation with such grace and fortitude. No blaming God or weeping about her lost husband, just getting on with it, the way that Hugo had been brought up to do. Just a child, he reminded himself. Far too young to touch the heart of a man of 35. The pigeons startled him, fluttering to land on one of the fallen beams. A snare, he thought. I should try to build a snare. And he thought back to his childhood. In those days, there had been poachers in the Langley Woods. The gamekeeper played a never-ending game of cat and mouse with them. A waste of time, really, Hugo had thought, because mostly they were only after rabbits. But the squire's pheasants had to be protected for the shoot. Hugo remembered going around the property with Ellison, the sour old gamekeeper, while the old man grumbled ceaselessly about the louts and layabouts and what he'd like to do to them, only stopping to destroy any traps he found. Some of them were vicious steel-toothed devices, strong enough to dig deep into an animal's foot. Others, probably made by local lads, were simple snares, wire hoops that would pull tight when an animal triggered them. Hugo tried to remember what they looked like and how they worked. No point, really, as he had no wire, but it was something to occupy his mind. He thought how pleased Sophia would be if he presented her with a brace of pigeons. He got to his feet, which was harder to do now with a splint in place, retrieved his makeshift crutch and hobbled to the door. The light clouds of morning had been replaced by heavy grey ones, and a thick bank of them was moving in from the west. The wind had picked up too, buffeting him as he tried to walk. It would rain before long, that was certain. He drank again from the rain barrel, and tried to do more foraging among the rubble. But he was unable to climb over the loose stones and bricks, and couldn't bend to lift any of the debris and see what lay beneath. He didn't find any wire or string, but he did manage to extricate an old kitchen drawer. That might just work, he thought, and began to carry it back, just as the first raindrops pattered onto the rock. He was only halfway to his shelter when the storm broke with force. It was as if the heavens had opened. Raindrops bounced off his leather jacket. He tried to move more quickly and felt himself slipping. He grasped at one of the beams and stopped himself from falling, sweat mixing with the rain on his face. By the time he had lowered himself into his shelter and pulled the parachute over him, he was soaked through. He lay there shivering as the wind blew raindrops through the gaps between his planks. The parachute's silk wasn't as waterproof as he had hoped. It clung to him, sodden. Then came a great flash of lightning, followed almost instantly by a clap of thunder. His first thought was of Sophia. Had she reached the safety of the village? He lay there, huddled under his parachute, worrying about her getting struck by lightning, or at the very least catching a cold from a drenching. And he cursed his own impotence. He was the man. He should be saving her, taking her and her son to a safe place far from this conflict. "Damn and blast this leg!" he said out loud. The storm raged on for most of the day. By evening there were periods of calm between bouts of heavy rain. Hugo didn't want to waste his candle. In the last of the daylight, he spread out his parachute to dry, draping it over the outside of his shelter. As he did so, he remembered the parachute lines.
"Idiot,"
he told himself. "You have all the string that you want to make a snare." Tomorrow, he would rig up a perfect trap and catch a pigeon. He ate the last of his bread with the onion, which tasted surprisingly good, then settled himself for the long night ahead. The blanket was not too damp, and he wrapped himself in it.
"Tomorrow, I will get to work," he told himself.
He had no idea how dramatically things would have changed by morning.
Chapter 14. Joanna. June 1973. My heart beat faster. She'd left a baby son behind. The beautiful boy. He might still be here. I took a deep breath and formed the sentence in my head before I asked, "So this son of Sophia, is he still in the village?" Paola nodded, smiling. "Yes, of course. He was taken in by Cosimo and raised as his own son." "Cosimo?" The smile faded from her face. "Cosimo di Giorgio, the richest man in our community. He owns much land around here. He would like to buy my olive grove. His aim is to control all the olive trees, but I do not wish to sell. But here he is respected as well as feared. In the war, he was a hero, a partisan fighter, the only one to survive a massacre by the Germans. He had to lie there among the bodies, pretending to be dead, while the soldiers went around with bayonets. Can you imagine that?" "So he adopted Sophia's child?" I asked. She nodded. "Yes, and lucky for the boy that was. Guido and Sophia, they were poor like the rest of us, but now Renzo is the heir to Cosimo. He will be rich one day, rich and powerful." Again, I phrased what I wanted to say very carefully. "If I wanted to meet this man, Renzo, how would I do so?" "If you go up to the village around 6 or 7, you will find most of the men sitting together in the piazza. They meet in the evenings while their wives prepare their meals. I am sure they will know where to find Cosimo and Renzo. Cosimo had a stroke a few years ago, I'm afraid." A stroke? This Italian word meant nothing to me.
"When the blood is blocked and the left side no longer works well," she explained. "Now he walks with a cane, and Renzo stays by his father's side to help him."
She reached for a towel and covered the bowl, wiping her hands on her apron. "Are we finished with the peachy?" I asked. "Do you need more help?"
"Until we cook it. Go and enjoy yourself, young lady."
I smiled and nodded. "So maybe I should go for a walk and explore the town. I'd like to see Sofia Bartoli's house."
"You can see it for yourself. As you walk up the street, you turn into the last little alley on the right. Sophia's house is at the end."
"Does her family still live in it?"
"Oh, no. Her husband did not return from the war in Africa, you know. There was only an old grandmother, and she died soon after I returned to San Salvatore."
I nodded, understanding this. "And I also want to see if I can talk to the men in the piazza," I said. "I don't know if they can tell me anything, but perhaps they met my father."
"Perhaps."
She didn't sound too hopeful. "And then, if I may, I'll come back to join you for dinner. I'm really looking forward to trying the peachy and the rabbit."
"Good."
She nodded approval.
"Of course you are welcome to join us. It will be nice for Angelina to have a young person to talk to. She is bored with just her old mother. She would like to know about English fashions, I am sure. And music. She is still a teenager at heart."
She chuckled. "How old is she?" I asked.
"Almost 20 now," Paola said. "Time to settle down and be serious as a mother and wife, not listening to popular music and wanting to dance."
Almost 20, I thought.
And here I am at 25, still thinking I am young and have plenty of time to decide what to do with my life. I went back to my room and collected my camera and purse. I also put on a hat as the late afternoon sun was fierce. Then I set off back up the path to the little town. The tunnel and the alleyway were pleasantly cool after the walk uphill with the sun on my back. I stood in the tunnel, looking out through the opening at the landscape beyond. Everywhere I looked, there were olive trees. If this Cosimo owned them all, he must be a rich man indeed. And that old ruin I could see beyond the trees, was that a castle, perhaps? I thought it might be worth exploring if I didn't mind the trek up through the olive groves. This made me stop and think. How long was I planning to stay here? If nobody in the town knew anything of my father, what would be the point of staying on? But I thought of Paola and her bright, warm kitchen, and it struck me that this was a place where I might be able to begin to heal. The piazza was deserted at this time of the afternoon, the sun beating down on the cobblestones and reflecting off the faded yellow stucco of the municipal buildings. The sycamore trees looked dusty and drooped in the heat. I went up the steps and into the church. The smell of incense hung heavy in the air, and dust motes danced in the shafts of sunlight that came in through high, narrow windows. Around the walls were old paintings and statues of saints. I recoiled as I came upon an altar, and beneath it a glass-fronted case containing a skeleton clothed in bishop's robes and with a crown on its skull. Was this a local saint? As one raised with only the minimum of Anglican exposure, I always found Catholic churches to be frightening places, one step away from black magic. When a priest appeared from behind the high altar, I made a hasty exit. I followed the one road up from the piazza. There were a few more shops and a jumble of houses clinging to one another against the hillside. Here and there an alley led off, some of them so small that I could stretch out my arms and touch both sides. Shutters were closed against the afternoon heat. Some houses had wooden balconies decorated with more geraniums. Others had big clay pots and jars like the one outside Paola's house, all with flowers and herbs spilling over the sides. An occasional cat basked in the sun. Other than that, the street was deserted. From inside the houses came the sounds of pots and pans clanging as the evening meal was being prepared. Babies crying, a radio blaring out a plaintive song. Ahead of me, I could see sky and greenery as the houses came to an end. I turned into the last alleyway on the right and found myself staring at Sophia's house. It was bigger than the houses around it and painted yellow, its paint faded and peeling. Two stories high with a balcony at the front, it must have had a fine view over the surrounding countryside at the back. I wondered who lived in it now, but it had a deserted feel to it. No geraniums, no window boxes. A sad house, I felt, and turned away. As I came to the highest point of San Salvatore, the road abruptly ended in a little park with a couple of large old trees and benches beneath them. An elderly couple sat on one of the benches in the shade. She was dressed head to toe in black like the other old woman on the train. He was rather smart in a starched white shirt, and he had a big nicotine-stained moustache. I was touched to see that they were holding hands. They looked at me with interest. I nodded and said, "Buongiorno."
"Buonasera," they replied,
a gentle rebuke that the day had now officially passed into evening. I continued to where a wall ran around the parapet, and next to the wall a big cross had been erected. I read the inscription, "To our brave sons lost in the war of 1939-45. Beyond was a glorious view. Range after range of forested hills, some crowned with villages such as this one. Directly below the wall, the land plunged away into a deep valley where I could see a road, but there was no way down from the village to join it. Clearly this was a place built for defense in the old days. I stood there taking photos of the view. When I looked back, the old couple had gone, making me wonder if I had only imagined them. In truth, this whole town had a tinge of unreality for me, like being in a beautiful but unsettling dream. Was it only yesterday that I had been in rainy London? Was it only a year ago that I had moved in with Adrian? And my father had let me know in no uncertain terms how much he disapproved. And then,
I closed my eyes as if trying to shut out the painful memories. How much can happen in so short a time? I thought. How quickly life can change. Well, maybe it was time that it changed again. I was in a beautiful place, staying with a kind woman, and I was going to enjoy myself, whatever the outcome was. Having made that decision, I started to walk back through the town. In just half an hour or so, things had changed. The world was coming to life. Small boys were playing football in the street while a little girl sat on a step watching them. The greengrocer was carrying in crates of vegetables, ready to shut up shop for the night. A group of women stood talking together, waving their hands expressively as only Italians do. From open front doors came enticing aromas and the sounds of radios or televisions playing, and when I arrived back in the piazza, it was now bathed in deep shadow and pleasantly cool. I saw that the men had returned to their table outside the trattoria, and were arguing so loudly and violently that I was afraid a fight might break out at any moment. I shrank back into the shadows of the side street, not wanting them to know I was there at such a crucial time. Then one of them threw up his hands in a gesture of futility, another laughed, and the moment was diffused. Wine was poured from a carafe on the table, and it appeared that everyone was contented again. All the way through the town I had rehearsed my lines for my upcoming speech. I had actually written some of them on the train, to be memorized in case my fledgling Italian deserted me in a moment of stress. It took me a few seconds of deep breathing to pluck up the courage to walk across the piazza to them. They looked up at the sound of my approaching footsteps.
"Ah, the signorina," one said. "Did you find Paola? Do you stay in her animal house?"
"Yes, thank you," I said. "It's very nice, and she is kind."
"Paola is a good woman," one of the men agreed. "She will feed you well. You need feeding up, no flesh on your bones."
I didn't quite understand this, but saw them examining me critically. Not plump enough to be an Italian girl. "I have come to find out about my father," I said. "He was a British airman. His plane crashed near this town in the war, but he survived. I wondered if any of you knew about him or met him." They were all middle-aged, or even elderly. Some of them must have been in the village at that time. But I was met with blank looks. Then an older, wizened man said,
"There was a plane that crashed down in Paolo's fields, remember? The Germans came and asked us about it, but we knew nothing. I remember that Marco was angry because the plane burned two good olive trees,"
another man agreed.
"But of that plane there were no survivors, I am sure. It was burned completely."
It occurred to me that they were not talking about my father's plane. Perhaps his plane had not crashed exactly in this area, and he had been making his way south to escape from German-held territory when he came to San Salvatore. Clearly none of these men knew anything of a British pilot in their town. I decided to change the subject. "Do any of you remember a woman called Sofia Bartoli?" That produced an immediate reaction. I was met with hostile stares. One of the men turned and spat on the ground. "Did this woman do something bad?" I asked.
"She ran off with a German," one of the men said finally. "Just before the Allies were driving the filthy Germans north, she was seen going off with him in the middle of the night, escaping in an army vehicle."
"Going willingly with him?" I asked. "Are you sure of that?"
"Of course. It was the one who had been staying in her house. A good-looking man, an officer. My wife was told by Sophia's grandmother that she knew she was sweet on a man. Well, you can tell, can't you, when a woman has feelings for a man. She obviously thought she'd have a better life in Germany than staying here, working day after day in the fields,"
a man at the end of the table muttered.
"Especially if her husband was already dead."
There were more mutters of agreement. "She left behind a child?" I asked. "A baby boy?" There were nods around the table.
"Yes, Renzo, her son. She abandoned him."
"And Renzo still lives in this town?" One of them looked up.
"Here he comes now, with his father."
Chapter 15. Joanna. June 1973. Two men were walking together into the piazza. One was a big bull of a middle-aged man, powerfully built with the grey curly hair and profile of the Roman Caesars. Yet in spite of his powerful appearance, he walked with a stick. The other was tall, muscular, and remarkably good-looking. He had the same strong chin, dark eyes, and mass of unruly dark curls. He was wearing a white shirt, opened several buttons down to reveal a tanned chest and dark, form-fitting trousers. The effect was of a romantic poet, although rather more healthy-looking. A fleeting thought crossed my mind that it would be highly unfair if the most attractive man I had ever seen turned out to be my brother, until I reminded myself that I had sworn off men. I kept staring at him, trying to see any hint of my father in him, but he was nothing like my slim and fair-haired father. I was wondering what to say to them when one of the men called out, "This young English lady is asking about Sophia Bartoli's son." The younger man, who I presumed was Renzo, gave me a cold stare. "I have the misfortune to be that woman's son," he said in remarkably good English. "But I remember nothing of her. What do you wish to know?"
"You speak English?"
I was surprised and impressed. The man nodded.
"I spent a year working in London, in a restaurant."
"Were you a waiter?"
I was hoping to break down the obvious hostility that I could feel.
"I was studying to be a chef," he said. "But then my father had a stroke. I had to return home to help him run his lands and his businesses."
He turned to give a deferential nod to the older man. One of the men had risen and pulled out a chair for him.
"Here, Cosimo, take my seat," he said.
"Not necessary,"
the older man said.
"We go inside to eat. Our table awaits us."
So that was Cosimo, the richest man in the town, the one who owned all the olive groves except for Paola's. He touched Renzo's arm and let out a rapid fire of words in Italian. Renzo turned back to me.
"My father wishes to know what your interest is in Sophia Bartoli."
I hesitated. "I believe that my father once knew her." Again, the older man said something in rapid Italian and the men grinned. Renzo looked quite uncomfortable as he said,
"My father thinks that maybe quite a few men knew her."
The older man was continuing to stare at me.
"You are German, I think,"
he said in accented English. "No, I'm English."
"I think German,"
he repeated.
"I think you are Sophia Bartoli's child with that German scum, and now you have come to reclaim her land and her olive grove."
"Absolutely not," I said angrily. "My father was a British pilot. His plane was shot down. He was badly injured."
I was still watching Renzo, wondering if he could have been the beautiful boy who was hidden away where only Sophia and my father could find him. But my father had written, "Our beautiful boy, not your." That implied the child was theirs, not hers. Perhaps he had developed a real attachment to the little boy.
"Tell me," I said, "were you ever hidden away during the war?"
"Hidden? How do you mean?"
"Hidden away where nobody could find you, to keep you safe."
"From the Germans?"
He frowned, then shook his head.
"I have no such memory. In fact, that cannot be. I remember we had a German officer staying in our house. He was kind to me. I do not have a bad memory of him. He gave me sweets."
"How old are you?" I asked, realizing that I was probably sounding very rude.
"You ask many questions for a woman and a stranger to this place,"
Renzo said.
"I don't see what this has to do with you, but I am 32, and in case you wish to know, I am not married. Are you?"
I felt myself blushing now. "I'm not married either." So he was too old to be my father's child. I knew that my father had crashed and been wounded toward the end of the war, and this man had been born in 1940 or 1941.
"And did you ever have a little brother?" I asked.
"This was not possible."
He gave me a scathing look.
"My real father was sent to Africa before I was born,
and he never returned. If it had not been for Cosimo, I would have been a destitute orphan. I owe everything to him.
He put a hand on Cosimo's arm.
Now, if you will excuse me, my father wishes to have a drink at his favorite table.
And they walked together into the trattoria. Once they were inside, the man sitting closest to me said in a low voice,
"That man is Cosimo. It is no good to cross him. He is powerful. He owns much land around here, and the olive press too."
A younger man got up and motioned for me to sit at the table.
"Come, join us for a drink," he said. "Sit. Get her a glass, Massimo, and try some of our local olives. They are the best."
I hesitated, wondering how to refuse and whether it was possible that I would learn anything more from them. The man insisted, and I sat. A glass was put in front of me and filled with dark red wine. A bowl of olives was pushed down the table along with a loaf of coarse bread and a jug of olive oil. The man who had invited me, a skinny individual with slicked back hair and a slightly racy look, tore off some bread for me and poured a little of the oil onto my plate.
"This is from our olive trees," he said. "Good Tuscan oil. Extra virgin, eh? Good to be extra virgin."
The way he said the word virgin combined with the way he looked at me made me uneasy. But then he laughed, and I decided he was only teasing.
"You see the color of our olive oil?"
A broad-shouldered man sitting opposite me asked.
"Bright green, the green of springtime. That is the color of Tuscan olive oil. The best. Of course, it has to come from my trees."
"Your trees?"
one of the men at the far end of the table demanded.
"You sold most of your trees to Cosimo. Now it comes from his trees." "Not true. I kept the best trees for myself." "I heard he made you an offer too good to refuse. Or he had something on you."
"Not true. You lie."
Voices were raised again, and I thought they might well break into a fist fight. But then an older man said,
"The signorina will think she has arrived among wild animals. Behave. Now eat, signorina. Eat. Drink. Enjoy yourself."
They all watched as I dipped the bread in the oil and then ate with an expression of satisfaction.
"Good, no?" they asked. "The best olives in the region."
"And could be even better,"
the young, racy one said, giving a look I couldn't quite interpret. One of the men put a finger to his lips.
"It's not wise to say such things, Gianni, especially when someone might be able to overhear us. Watch your mouth, or you will be sorry."
The distinguished old man with a shock of white hair took over the conversation.
"So tell us, signorina, your father, the British pilot, he is still alive? He sent you here to find Sofia Bartoli?"
"No, signor," I said. "He died a month ago. I came here because I found her name mentioned among his belongings. He never spoke of her to me or my mother, but I was curious. Now I see I was wrong to delve into the past. My father would not be happy to learn of her actions, but at least I have seen this beautiful region, and I am glad I came."
"You will now go back to England?"
the older man asked. "I may stay for a few days. I am happy in the little room at Signora Rossini's house. I will take walks and enjoy your beautiful countryside." This was generally approved of.
"You must let me show you my sheep,"
the amorous one said.
"I keep them up at the top of the mountain where the grass is the best, and I make my pecorino cheese up there. I will show you how I make my cheese, too."
"You want to watch that one, signorina?"
the distinguished one said.
"He has a reputation with the ladies. You can't trust him further than you can throw him."
"What, me?"
the man who I now remembered was called Gianni asked, putting his hand to his heart.
"I am merely showing hospitality to a young stranger. I am a safely married man."
"Married, yes. Safe, no,"
one at the far end commented, causing loud laughter. Gianni looked sheepish.
"We should feed the young lady. Bread and olives is not enough." "Let's call for bruschetta."
"Oh, no, it's not necessary." I held up my hand. I go back to eat at Signora Rossini's.
She won't serve dinner for hours, Gianni said. Not until the sun is well and truly set. You will faint from hunger before that.
He got up and went into the darkness of the trattoria. Then he came back, looking self-satisfied.
They will bring a tray for us. Very good here, you will see.
I had no idea what bruschetta was. My knowledge of Italian food was limited to spaghetti bolognese or ravioli of the sort one bought in a tin. Soon a platter was carried out to our table by a skinny young man wearing an apron. On it were thick slices of toasted bread with different toppings. Gianni looked at me with intense interest and said something under his breath to one of the men. The man replied. They exchanged a smile. A translation was not offered to me.
So now you try the bruschetta, the distinguished older man said. Each one is crowned with different flavors that we like in these parts. This one has chicken liver mixed with anchovy, this one tapenade, and this slices of fennel with goat cheese. Eat. They are all good.
I was all too aware that I was going back to Paola to eat what would undoubtedly be a large meal, but I could hardly refuse. They insisted that I try every flavor, watching my face with expressions of anticipation, so that I had to smile broadly and nod satisfaction after each bite. This was not hard to do, as each of the flavors was exquisite. I had grown up with simple English cooking, steak and kidney pie, shepherd's pie, fish and chips, lamb chops, and then as a student my daring experiments in the culinary line were limited by my budget and included Chinese and Indian, or rather the English versions of Chinese and Indian. Therefore I was not familiar with garlic or basil or any of the other tastes I was experiencing. At last, full of food and wine, I was able to plead that Paola would be waiting for me, and it would be very rude to be late for dinner. Gianni, who had volunteered to show me his sheep farm and had insisted on a bruschetta, immediately got to his feet.
I shall have the honor of escorting the young lady home, he said.
Oh, no, thank you. It is not far, and I know the way. And it is still not quite dark, I said, having trouble with finding Italian words after too much wine.
It is no trouble, Gianni said. I, too, must go home through the tunnel. Come.
He put a hand on my elbow and assisted me to my feet. I wasn't too keen to go through a long, dark tunnel with him, even though I didn't think he'd try anything within shouting distance of the men at the table. Luckily, this was decided for me before I could find a way to refuse him.
Never mind, Gianni,
a voice at the end of the table said. I looked across at a big man in a well-worn undershirt.
I must pass Paola's house, and it is time for me to leave if I do not want a lashing from my wife's tongue. Come, signorina. You will be quite safe with me. I have 10 children and a terrifying wife to keep me in line.
There was good-natured laughter around the table, but the white-haired one said,
Yes, signorina. You will be quite safe with Alberto.
I thanked them profusely for their hospitality and remembered to comment again on the quality of their olive oil. This was met with broad smiles all around. At least I had done something right.
So tomorrow, signorina.
Gianni still hovered beside me.
Any time you want to see my sheep and my cheese making, you come and find me, okay? I can tell you lots of interesting things. Also about the wartime. What do you know of the war?
One of them bellowed.
You were just a child. We were off fighting. We can tell her what the war was like. I was a child, yes, but I ran errands. I took messages for the partisans. I saw much,
Gianni said.
You would be interested, I think, signorina. You and your tall tales.
Alberto shoved him aside and took my arm to lead me away from the group.
That Gianni, he is full of hot air,
Alberto said to me.
You must take anything he says with a pinch of salt, signorina. In the wartime he ran messages, but they were more likely to be for the black market dealers than the partisans. No partisan would have trusted him with an important message. He'd have blabbed about it to the wrong people, and squealed to the Germans if they had questioned him.
We walked then in silence across the piazza and through the tunnel. I suspected that he was now tongue-tied, and perhaps was already wondering what the shrewish wife would say about being seen with a young lady. On the other side of the tunnel, we emerged into the last of the pink twilight. Bats were flitting and swooping silently across our path, attacking the mosquitoes that now hummed around us. We reached the path to Paola's front door.
"Here we are, signorina,"
Alberto said.
"May I wish you a good appetite for your evening meal, and a good sleep."
He gave a quaintly old-fashioned bow, and then strode off down the path that led to the valley.
Chapter 16. Hugo. December 1944. In the middle of the night, Hugo awoke with teeth chattering. His whole body was shivering and shaking. He sat up and felt around for Guido's shirt that he had stuffed into the parachute bag under his head. It took him a while to extricate it, take off his bomber jacket, then put the shirt on. It smelled of damp sheep, but was actually nicely dry. By the time he got the jacket on again, he could not control the shaking. He tried to huddle himself into a ball, but it was impossible with his splinted leg. The shaking finally ceased, leaving him exhausted and drenched with sweat. It was all he could do to stop himself from tearing off his leather jacket. He passed into black dreams. He was flying, and was surrounded by mosquitoes trying to bite him. Then the mosquitoes turned into German planes, tiny, vicious planes, zooming around his head as he batted at them ineffectively.
"Go away!"
he shouted into the darkness.
"Leave me alone!"
Then the planes turned into fluid flying creatures, and they left him, swooping across a red sky to where Sophia was walking through the olive groves. And they descended on her, grabbing at her shawl and her dress, trying to lift her up.
"No, not Sophia!"
He was screaming now, struggling to stand up and run to her, but his legs had turned to jelly and collapsed under him. He watched helplessly as they lifted her up and bore her away into the darkness.
"Sophia!"
he cried out in despair.
"Don't go! Don't leave me!"
"Sono qui. I am here,"
said a quiet voice beside him. Someone was stroking his hair. He opened his eyes with difficulty. It was day, and a watery sun was peeping over the jagged edge of the chapel wall. His head was still pounding, and he had difficulty focusing, but gradually he could make out Sophia's sweet little elfin face looking down at him with concern.
"You were shouting,"
she said. "Was I? I was dreaming, I think." She knelt beside him.
"And your forehead is so hot. You have a bad fever. I am afraid your wound has become infected. Let me see."
He was too weak to stop her as she unbuckled his belt and eased down his trousers.
"Your clothing is wet with sweat,"
she said, shaking her head. Carefully she inched off his makeshift bandage, then shook her head some more.
"You need a doctor. This looks very bad."
She stared at his leg, chewing on her lip like a nervous child, trying to make up her mind.
"I think Dr. Martini is a good man. He was good to Renzo when he caught measles."
"No doctor," Hugo said. "It is a risk we should not take. At the very least, he would be seen coming up here."
"That is true,"
she nodded.
"But if we do not bring a doctor, I think you might die."
"So be it," he said. "I would rather die than risk your life any more." She took his hand.
"You are a brave man, Ugo. I hope your wife appreciates what a good and kind man."
Even in his fever, this made him smile. He didn't think that Brenda would ever describe him as brave, good, or kind. But then at home he had been a different person, arrogant, selfish, playing at the lord of the manor.
"I will do my best for you,"
she said.
"Let us try this and see if it can disinfect the wound."
She took the small bottle of grappa.
"Good. You have not drunk it all."
She ripped a strip from the old sheet, then soaked it in the grappa. He screamed in pain as she washed the wound, then was ashamed of himself and bit into his lip to stop from screaming again.
"I have done my best,"
she said.
"It seems to be clean. Of course, I do not know what it is like inside, or if the bullet has damaged some blood vessel. We can only hope."
He watched as she made a pad of clean linen, then bound it to his leg.
"You have no more morphine?"
she asked.
"I'm afraid not. Just the one syringe. And I used that."
"No more medicines?"
He examined the first aid kit. There were a couple of small sticking plasters, big enough for a cut on the finger, and a strip of aspirins.
I have these. Aspirin. They will help take your fever down, that is good. But you should not become too cold.
She reached up inside his jacket.
Your shirt is quite wet, too. But I do not think we should try to remove it. Let us pull up your trousers quickly, and then I will wrap you in your blanket and the parachute.
She eased his trousers over the wound with great care, then up over his hips in a businesslike manner. Then she went to get water and held his head as he sipped it and swallowed 4 aspirin.
"And I have brought you more of the bean soup," she said. "You need nourishment. Can you eat a little?"
She took the covering from the basin and held him propped up against her as she fed him. He tried a few mouthfuls, then fell back against her, exhausted.
"You must eat. You must stay strong,"
she said.
"I can't. I'm sorry."
She got up then, easing him back against his pillow.
"I will go back to the village and see what medicines they have at the pharmacy that I can ask for without causing suspicion. Alcohol for your wound. That will be no problem. I have used all the grappa. I do not think they will give me a sulfur drug without a prescription, but I can try. I'll tell them that Renzo has a sore throat. It is true that he does, but only with a cold, nothing serious. Then I will try to come back tonight."
"You're so good to me," he said. "If this stupid war is ever over and I reach my home, I will try to make it up to you. I will send your son to a good school, buy you more goats, whatever you want."
"Let us not talk of the future," she said, giving him a sad smile. "Who knows what it may bring? We are all in the hands of God and the holy saints."
Then she tucked him in as if he was a little child, wrapping the parachute around him.
"Rest now."
She stood up.
"See? I leave you water to drink and the rest of the soup. If you can try to eat it, I think you should try."
She wagged a finger at him, making him smile.
"Very well. I will try."
As she walked away, he wondered if it would be the last time he would see her.
Chapter 17. Joanna. June 1973. Paola had clearly been waiting for me. She looked relieved when she opened the front door.
"Oh, Signora Langley, mia cara, there you are. I was worried that something had happened to you. I said to Angelina that you surely would not want to be out alone in the dark. What would you be doing?"
"I am so sorry, Signora," I said. "I talked to the men who sit in the piazza, and they insisted that I join them for a glass of wine. Then they ordered bruschetta, and it would have been rude to refuse. I told them I was eating dinner at your house, but they said you would not eat until very late." Paola laughed.
"It is no problem, my little one. I was merely concerned for your safety. Not that I think you run the risk of being unsafe in this village, but there are dark alleyways where you can trip and hurt yourself. Now come, sit. The dinner awaits us."
I followed her down the hall and was ushered into a dining room, this time with a table elegantly set with candles on it. Angelina was already there. The baby slept in its cradle at her feet.
"You see, Mamma, I told you she would be safe," Angelina said. "She is a girl from London, from a big city. She knows how to take care of herself and watch out for danger."
I laughed. "I did have to say no when the man called Gianni offered to take me home," I said. "I thought he was a little too friendly." Paola shrugged.
"He is all talk, that one. No real harm in him, at least not to the ladies. If you had become amorous, he would have run a mile."
Angelina laughed, too. "But in his business dealings, well, sometimes he does like to play with fire," she said.
"We don't know that," Paola said. "It is only rumors."
"It is what they say in the village," Angelina replied. "They say he is friendly with those who might be mafiosi. They say he might trade in stolen goods. And then there is the olive press." "Olive press?" I asked. Angelina nodded. "The only olive press for the whole community is owned by Cosimo. Did you meet Cosimo?" I did. He looked rather... I didn't have the Italian word for imposing.
He is powerful, Paola said. Rich and powerful.